So it's a great pleasure to welcome the final speaker for today, Stephen White from University of California, Irvine. And today he's going to be talking about tensor networks for quantum chemistry. Stephen, thanks a lot for giving this talk, and please take it away.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. So please go ahead and interrupt with questions along the way. This is sort of partly designed to be a talk for just telling sort of a broader audience about this particular area, which they might not know so much about. Probably most of you have seen these sorts of headlines, Google's quantum computer achieves chemistry milestone. So this was from Scientific American. And so quantum computers and the hype that's surrounding quantum computers are making quantum chemistry sort of famous as sort of a key application. And the companies are talking about things like drug design and new materials and all of these things that would make companies lots of money. So if this field is so exciting, shouldn't we be thinking about using tensor networks for simulating quantum chemistry? Of course, tensor networks is another shortcut around the exponential growth of Hilbert space. And so it's certainly worth exploring. But this is something that I've been thinking about in one way or another since graduate school. This paper is from when I was a graduate student, shared between Ken Wilson and John Wilkins. And my project was to try to apply Wilson's renormalization group ideas for solving quantum chemistry. This effort turned out to be before its time. We didn't have the tools like tensor networks back then. And so this effort sort of crashed and burned on the fermionic sign problem. So it lasted briefly, but anyway, that sort of gave me this sort of inclination to work on this problem. I've sort of been carrying the torch for Ken Wilson on this, who got this bug from his father, who was a well-known chemist. So what I want to do is give an overview of quantum chemistry, assuming your perspective is sort of knowing tensor networks and some quantum information, but not much about, say, quantum chemistry or condensed matter physics. Then I'm going to slowly move over to our work trying to do this using wavelets and using DMRG. Eventually, we want to take this farther, use things like PEPs, but we're still in the early stages of this. Okay, it's not wanting me to change my slide. Okay, I'm gonna have to stop sharing for a minute and then see if it works again. Okay, let me share again and we'll see if it works. Okay, let's hope this keeps working. Okay, so let's talk first at a sort of very basic level. The Hamiltonian that we want to solve and sort of energy scale, sort of simple analysis. So here's the Hamiltonian. Basically, we have n electrons with n sub a atoms or nuclei at fixed positions, big R, and the little r's are the coordinates of the electrons. We have the kinetic energy of all the electrons. The nuclei are stationary. The Coulomb interaction between the nuclei and the electrons, and electron-electron repulsion. So there's lots of other things that you can add, things like spin orbit interactions, phonons, et cetera. And we think of those as coming at the end with a perturbative treatment. So we can think about this by saying, imagine putting it on a grid. And sort of looking at the sort of grid size sort of energies and see what do we keep track of first and most importantly. So we have a grid with spacing A. The kinetic energy will blow up as or the terms Nickinetic energy will blow up as 1 over A squared. So we want to make sure that we don't make errors in sort of representing the kinetic energy, because those are big terms. The next biggest is another way to put it is that the kinetic energy ensures that the many particle wave function is generally very smooth. So as A goes to zero, this is not a field theory, it just we have smooth wave functions, except for the cusp singularities. So the biggest cusp singularities are at the nuclei, at these fixed positions, okay? But then we also have cusp singularities in relative coordinates whenever two particles come together, looking like this. So this sort of gives us some idea of how to think about this. Of course, putting the first two terms together, you're essentially solving a hydrogen-like problem. And so you can think of the cusps as being just like e to the minus absolute value of r. So the first two terms are one particle in the electrons. So those are in some sense easy. If we think about the hard part, the two electron interaction, it's useful to at least conceptually think about separating it into the short range and its long range parts. Now the long range part of the two electron interaction is crucial for maintaining charge neutrality as a whole. So that's absolutely essential that you don't mess that up too much. But on the other hand, that part couples many electrons at once. And we know from sort of monogamy arguments or just mean field arguments that if lots of things are coupled together at once, you can't have much individual entanglement. You think more of sort of a mean field sort of treatment. Going along with that sort of idea is that the short range part of this gets reduced in three dimensions by just the volume element. So these sort of general considerations sort of suggest that you could think of a mean field treatment for this problem where you're thinking of a fermionic determinant. And a pure fermionic determinant would be the Hartree-Fock theory. And then a sort of fancier thing is density functional theory. So what is density functional theory? Well, underlying any calculations with density functional theory is also just a single fermion determinant. But DFT cleverly brings in essentially information from quantum Monte Carlo calculations of an interacting electron gases, what their correlation is, energies are. You can also put in exact sum rules, et cetera. And it improves on the Hartree-Fock and generally can work significantly better, but it still has this underlying representation in terms of a single fermionic determinant. And so you're not gonna use it to try to describe superconductivity or a spin liquid or something with real strong correlation. So as a practical definition, strongly correlated in this sort of situation is usually synonymous with density functional theory doesn't work. Okay, so let me say a little bit more about strong correlations. So it turns out, so thinking in terms of quantum chemistry, the simplest sort of molecule you might write down is just H2. And this is an example of a molecule which is not strongly correlated at equilibrium, but along with many other molecules, it can become strongly correlated if there's a chemical reaction. So if you just pull it apart and break the bond. Okay, so looking on the right, here's the, we can think of the wave function as starting with the hydrogen atom wave functions, bring them together. And Hartree-Fock will work very well at close distances. The wave function is just the spatial part, is just a product of the same function, where roughly this function is just the sum of these two other single atom functions. Okay, but if you look at it in terms of when it's stretched, then we can think of it more as a Bell pair with sort of up on one atom and down on the other in a singlet. The spatial part looks like this. The key thing is that this excludes parts of the wave function where two electrons are on the same atom. And so it looks strongly correlated. And of course, this is a trivial sort of picture, but if you hand H2 that's being pulled apart to a density functional theory program, it will probably give a bad result. Okay, so that would be called strong correlation, but it's sort of a trivial thing because it's so small. So when there's strong correlation, then people resort to other methods. There's many of them. This is a rough division into different types. There's sort of nearly weakly correlated, where you can think of, say, perturbation theory about the mean field theory as giving you ways to calculate. And these can be based on Feynman diagrams. You think of the Feynman diagram representation as sort of giving you, the couple cluster is sort of one, can be looked at in that way. Configuration interaction is related in that you sort of take the perturbatively coupled low energy space of a few excitations and you diagonalize exactly within a subspace. Another type of method is you where you look at systems that are strongly correlated but small, and then you just can do an exact diagonalization. Okay, quantum Monte Carlo in a couple of different flavors is used. It can work very well, but then it also can suffer from a sign problem. Okay, and DMRG is used for quantum chemistry now, and this has the regime. It's fairly small, bigger than the regime of exact diagonalization, or if the system is particularly 1D, then it does very well. Okay, and we would love to add PEPS to this list, and someone who's pursuing this pretty vigorously is Garnet Chan. Okay, so when you want to do a calculation, the first thing you have to think about is mapping the continuum to a discrete Hamiltonian. And almost all electronic structure methods use a basis as opposed to, say, just a grid or some other representation. Some of the Monte Carlo works straight in the continuum, but most use a basis. And there are two types of basis sets that are dominant. The first is plane waves, which is sort of the standard basis set for solids. And that's because it's very good at implementing periodicity. Basically, you think of a periodic box. It has a key advantage that when you set up the Hamiltonian, you have to do integrals over the basis functions. And these integrals are analytic for the Coulomb interaction. This is not so good for a molecule in free space because you have to use a rather large box. Okay, and plane waves have the same resolution at every point within the box. They don't have any special ability to represent the nuclear cusps. So if you use plane waves, you have to smooth out the nuclear cusps, basically replace them with an limit. Worst thing about plane waves, though, is that they're completely non-local. And so if you just tried to put a plane wave system on in a tensor network, you'd get a volume law in the entanglement. Okay, so standard more for molecules are atom-centered Gaussians. So all of these Gaussian functions centered on each nucleus multiplied by a polynomial in X and Y to sort of represent the hydrogen wave functions. The Gaussians are very highly adapted to each atom through extensive calculations. So originally people tried to look at things that were closer to just hydrogen atom wave functions and use those as a basis, but it turned out that doing all the integrals was sort of too burdensome. So Gaussians came along where all the integrals were analytic. And it turns out that with just 5 or 10 Gaussians of different widths, you can represent e to the minus z times r very accurately. So it's actually, it's rather good at representing the nuclear cusp. Okay, so that's certainly much better for thinking about tensor networks because they're not as non-local, but they have the problem that when you you have them on, they're non-orthogonal from the start. And you can orthogonalize them just by recombining them, but that makes them somewhat non-local. They tend to have tails that extend across the system. And so the worry is that you're going to get some sort of volume law because your functions here are touching the distant places, parts of the system, at least to some extent. Now, it doesn't seem to be as bad as all that, but it's still a worry. The other drawback with both of these basis function type methods is that the two-electron interaction has 4 indices just from, recomposing the fermionic operators and writing it down, you'll get this form of the interaction. And so we want to consider large basis sets, but you have this n to the fourth scaling of the size of your Hamiltonian. And even if you're trying to do a quantum computer, this can be sort of a killer too. Okay. So most of the methods though start from this Hamiltonian. They will probably rotate it one more step to go to the Hartree-Fock orbitals. They may try to localize the functions, but they'll still have these tails. Okay, so DMRG is an established method now in quantum chemistry. So I worked on this in 1999, the idea is to use exactly this framework and to take that Hamiltonian and to realize, well, its Hilbert space is that of a Hubbard model. It's just got lots of terms. If we can simplify the terms a bit, maybe the calculation will not be so bad. And so there's this thing called complementary operators, which is a way of reducing the complexity of doing DMRG within this sort of complicated Hamiltonian. And it involves working with operators that have some of the summations done. So you sort of pick off I here and you sum on the other two and you work that for part of the calculation and then later you have to expand it out. Nowadays, this sort of idea is a key part of a number of the things we do, but now we just sort of lump it together in terms of compressing the matrix product operator. We have better developed ways of compressing the matrix product operators, things that use singular value decompositions and work pretty well. So we can just think of this as a part of that. So that's part of the machinery. Our first calculation used 25 Gaussian functions to treat one water molecule. And since that time, the field has progressed a long way. A lot of this is due to the work of Garnet Chan and his group. And now one can do about 100 active orbitals. This is still much smaller than we can do with DMRG in a Hubbard model. And it's because of this n to the fourth scaling of the interaction. Okay. With that, you can actually solve some very interesting and sort of state-of-the-art problems. And to do that, you need to sort of focus on an active space and freeze a lot of the electrons. It's sort of like constructing a Hubbard model for the cuprate, say, where we just consider the active ones. But this is closer to the real calculation. You have a lot more of the ingredients left in, but you do have some of the orbitals frozen. And then you can do really interesting things like this complicated molecule called the oxygen evolving complex, which is responsible for photosynthesis. But we're still very far from what we can simulate in terms of just the size of the system than with local, what we can do with local models like the Hubbard model. So for at least 5 years, I've been sort of working on trying to go beyond quantum chemistry DMRG, this sort of framework. And the main effort has focused on the construction of the Hamiltonian. So we want to simplify that Hamiltonian, make it more convenient to allow DMRG, and eventually we hope PEPs can be made to work on this sort of system as well as they're working in on Hubbard models, which is really pretty well nowadays. Okay, so what are we focusing on? Well, we want better locality. We're worried about these tails of the wave functions. We're worried about the area law. And we want reduced complexity of the two-electron interaction. Okay, now going to a grid is a good step in that direction. And our first two approaches, which I'm just gonna describe briefly on this page, were based on 1D grid representations. The first thing that we did was just in the context of toy 1D models. These 1D models had one-dimensional atoms with, you know, long-range interactions. They were designed to give us sort of a toy system to use to understand density functional approximations. And Miles Studenmeyer, who was a postdoc here, was heavily involved in this, along with Kieran Burke and his group. We could do pretty big systems, 4,000 lattice sites involved, just a fine grid, which could handle up to 100 of these pseudo-atoms. Here's an example of a calculation. This isn't even all the calculation. This is just the middle section of a very long system. And in the bottom part, we see comparisons with results from some density functional approximations. The key to doing this was this MPO compression that I mentioned, so that the grid automatically gives you interactions that go only as n squared. With the MPO compression, we could get that down to almost purely linear. And so that's how we could do such long systems. Okay, now our next approach was pretty similar to this, but it actually applies not to toy systems, but to realistic chain systems. And our realistic chain system, one that we really focused on a lot, is a set of hydrogen atoms equally spaced, set along a line with some finite number of them. This is not a bad model of a one-dimensional solid. And it's not chemically stable by any means. Maybe someone will be able to make something like this on with cold atoms. But mostly it's a model for developing our calculations. So we use a 1D grid in the long direction, just like in the above. But for the transverse directions, we use some Gaussians. We might just put one. So in this fancy picture of the hydrogen chain here is a slice through x equals zero. And you can't see them, but there are slices that go in the vertical direction here that slice it up. And so of course, if you're lined up with a nucleus like I am here, then you're gonna need a different Gaussian than if you're in between. And so you do that. And you use as few Gaussians as you can. Okay. This turns out to scale not so differently from the toy calculations. And so in particular with this great compression, we could actually get a linear scaling in the length. And we actually did some test calculations with 1,000 atoms with just one Gaussian per slice. And you can get pretty good sort of accurate total energies if you use, say, up to 12 Gaussians. Okay, but this was just sort of the initial steps. It's sort of highly 1D oriented. If you think about doing three dimensions, real three-dimensional systems, this fine grid spacing that we're using is going to kill us. And so we want to think about getting a very coarse grid spacing. And so our ultimate goal is to generate very coarse, very accurate 3D grids for use with DMRG and PEPs. Okay, and meanwhile, we have MIRA as sort of a really nice way to implement real space renormalization groups. So can we use MIRA to decimate our grid. So we began thinking about this. This ended up being a real nice set of projects with Glenn Evenly, who will talk about things like this later on in the week. We heard a little bit about it in just the last talk. So in thinking about this, going back to sort of what energy scales dominates, if you're at a very fine scale, the initial part of your discretization, the kinetic energy dominates. And so we want to first think about this in a single particle framework, and we can think about it in 1D. So if we write down the simplest Mira layer and then reinterpret this in terms of, instead of the usual tensor product space, but go to the much simpler direct sum space, the free fermion space, the idea for this space is just that it's just like, this is like the Fourier transform as opposed to Fourier transform in the fermion creation operators. If you have a diagram like this with 100 sites, it's really represented by a 100 by 100 matrix. So incredibly easier to work with. But it still essentially embodies a Mira. And so we can look at the simplest sort of Mira and now think about what we're doing in terms of thinking about basis functions. Okay, so you could think of minimizing the energy, say just the kinetic energy for a system like this, but there's a nice idea that we should choose these disentanglers and isometries, not to minimize the energy directly, but we want to take the degrees of freedom that are thrown out here, the dots, and make those their functions, and we want to make those functions orthogonal to low order polynomials. And if you do that, then the states that are left that get carried up in the Mira can represent all smooth functions because of just Taylor series. It turns out that this simple way of thinking, this representation, generates Daubechies' famous wavelets. And this is a sort of section of this picture. This is a more detailed picture from Glenn and my first paper on this, showing more of the Mira, which is actually a wavelet transform. Here are these famous Daubechies wavelet forms. You can see they're not very smooth, and so that's a certain disadvantage. These are Fourier transforms. Okay, but this connection then can be used in two different ways. The first is that the wavelet technology can help us to get coarse grids, and so that's the way we were thinking about it, or I was at first. The other thing is that the Mira technology may be able to make better wavelets. And I didn't think that this was necessarily we were going to be able to do that, because wavelets are such a well-developed field. But when Glenn came to be my postdoc and work on this, he really knows Mira and a lot of tricks. And he did some beautiful work figuring out how to create new wavelets. Okay. And one of the things that he sort of focused on was that, one of the things that you ordinarily don't get in wavelets is symmetric functions. And that really traces down to the wavelets are almost always done with a binary decimation. So you can also make circuits that have a ternary representation, a ternary decimation. Those allow you to get nice symmetric wavelets. And so Glenn and I developed these techniques to get these very nice wavelets. My favorite one here is this one shown here. This is sort of after one layer, where you still see the grid. And then if you go to the scale invariant continuum limit, these all just turn into functions. And so here's our scaling function, which carries the low momentum parts. And then here are the two wavelets, which nicely divide up Fourier space into different sort of overlapping pieces. Okay, so my intention was to use this technology for solving quantum chemistry. It went through one more iteration before we got there, which is that wavelets are, if you take these fixed point functions, there's no analytic formula for them. They're hard to do the integrals on. And when you set up a big calculation, you may have to do millions or billions of integrals. to set up your Hamiltonian. We hope it's small enough so that there aren't so many, but there's still an awful lot of them. You would really like to have analytic integrals, or at least ones that are very easy to work with. So I developed these things called Gausslets, which start with one of our ternary sorts of wavelets, but it tries to create a wavelet function with only one layer of the wavelet transform, not the scale invariant. And it starts with a uniform array of Gaussians with an approximate orthogonalizer. And then the rest of the orthogonalization is done through this layer. And you put these together and you optimize the pieces with, you know, letting your computer try to optimize for weeks. And eventually you get these functions that have lots of very nice properties. One of the nice properties is that they have this exact form for them. Just as a sum of over a uniform grid of Gaussians, you just need to know these coefficients to use them. Here's a picture of this Gausslet and several of the Gaussians that add up to make this. So these are exactly orthonormal. They have polynomial completeness. They can represent any polynomial up to 10th order, essentially exactly. And they also have a very interesting property that they integrate like a delta function to very high order. So what that means is that if we took our function here and we multiply it by x squared and integrate it, you would get zero. Do it by x to the fourth, you get zero. You get lots of polynomials giving zero. All the odd ones, because it's perfectly symmetric, all the odd ones are automatically zero. Okay, well, why do we care about that? Well, it turns out that this integrating like a delta function gives us a huge benefit when we construct our Hamiltonian. Okay, so what you get is a diagonal approximation for the interactions. Okay, what is this? So let's suppose we have any function which we have a grid of these functions, and they're orthonormal, and they have nice completeness, but they also have this delta function property that they just sample the function at the midpoint for all sorts of smooth functions. Okay, now you can use these functions and construct the usual Hamiltonian, which will be off diagonal, but you can also use this delta function property and construct a Hamiltonian in an alternative way. So you can basically take, say, it's easiest to look at the single particle Schrodinger equation and stick in this representation with these delta function Gausslets. Okay, and it just samples the wave function at one point. And so you can replace the potential by just the sampling at this one point. So essentially you sort of come along and write your equation as part of the Schrodinger equations, then just start sampling it at this point, and you find out that you have a representation of the Hamiltonian as a diagonal matrix. Okay, and here's the results for using that is shown in this test. Now, this is just a different way to reach the continuum limit. It's not quite as fast at getting to the continuum limit as a standard approach, but it's also it converges very fast. So here's some 1D tests with this diagonal approximation. The original full Hamiltonian is shown by the dashed black line, but these various slight variations on this diagonal approximation are shown here, and they all converge very nicely to the exact result. The key thing is that the two particle terms, you can do exactly the same thing. You just do it twice and you get a collapse of the four index thing to a two index thing. Okay, so that's a Gausslet basis gives a Vij interaction just like it was a grid. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about, so one can use those as they are, but there are some other ingredients that are sort of important to make a practical calculation, and we really wanted to sort of jump right away into sort of practical calculations. Okay, so the next sort of trick to improve this is so far the Gausslets live on a uniform grid, and you'd have to make the grid spacing still fairly small to represent the core region. So can we get a resolution which actually varies in space while maintaining the orthogonality in the diagonal approximation? Well, we just do a coordinate transformation. So we consider some coordinate transformation. We have to put the square root of the Jacobian into the definition of our new functions, and that will maintain orthonormality. Okay. It also maintains this delta function property. And so as long as this is a very smooth transformation, it doesn't change too fast on the scale of the functions, we'll maintain this delta function property. So here's a graph of the scale transformation. On the vertical axis, you see this in this U space, we have an evenly spaced grid of these Gausslets. But in the mapped space, we put a lot more. We're imagining the nucleus is here at zero. And here's the functions when you put in everything and plot out what they look like. This is what they look like. So this would imagine a sort of 1D nucleus here. OK, so how about three-dimensional variable grid Gausslet basis sets? So the easiest thing to do, the only thing that we've done, is to make 3D Gausslets just as products of the 1D functions. Okay. So we do distortions. There's a simple way to do this distortions and a slightly fancier way, and we're working on a third way. Here's the simplest type of distortion, where you make the distortion just a product of distortions over each coordinate axis. Okay, and so this is a system where we have nuclei at the red x's, and then we can sort of build up a higher resolution in this region. Here's what we call multi-slicing, which sort of goes through one coordinate direction, then the next, and does them sort of independently. And this is actually, the red and the circles are actually two different grids with different spacings. But you can see they sort of do a better job of sort of zeroing in on the nucleus, but they still have inefficiencies along certain directions. So there's still room for improvement here. Okay, so now we have the ingredients to actually do three-dimensional calculations. So let me show you results. Okay, we've done a few very small molecules, but most of our work has been done with this sort of benchmark system, these hydrogen chains. We started using those. This is part of our Simons collaboration on the many electron problem. We wanted to compare the sort of state of the art of many of these sophisticated techniques for electronic structure in a simple sort of context. And so these hydrogen chains are sort of very useful. They have some of the character of a solid, except that they're one-dimensional, but they have all the realistic ingredients like a long-range Coulomb interaction and really working in the continuum that you have in a realistic problem. Okay, so we sort of did a benchmark paper where we compared all sorts of different methods, and I plotted them here just to you can sort of. So what's going on is the x-axis is just plotting these different techniques. So it's just so you can see all of the different results on the same curve in some sort of systematic way. This DZ here is, these were all done in Gaussian basis sets, and DZ stands for double zeta. And so that means that there's two S functions, one P function. So the D double stands for the number of S functions. QZ is four S functions, 5Z is five S functions. And then it goes down one at a time, each shell. So that tells you how many Gaussians there are from a standard basis set. So using the same, so that standard basis set gives you the same Hamiltonian. And then you can apply these various electronic structure methods and see how well they sort of do in solving the Schrodinger equation in this finite system. And the methods that are based on sort of weak sort of perturbation theory, aren't perfect, but they're not so bad. So this is a one version of coupled cluster. And here's another version of coupled cluster. And this is sort of a higher order coupled cluster, another higher order coupled cluster. We're doing the what we think is the exact result for that basis is shown by the horizontal line. The quantum Monte Carlo is, this version is doing very well. DMRG is essentially serving as the sort of reference exact result for that basis. And some methods actually are not variational, so they go below. So then the trouble is that double zeta is an inaccurate basis set. So you need to crank up the accuracy of the basis set. And so you go up to quadruple zeta, and a lot of the methods drop out because using that big a Hamiltonian is too hard to carry out the calculations. So we have fewer of them. And you have similar ones that are doing well. And then you go to the next level of the number of Gaussians, and only two of the methods were still able to do that. Okay, and what we think is the final result is this red dashed line. Okay, so what this was sort of our first real attempt of using these multi-sliced Gausslets with DMRG. And it's mostly a lot of the same data as over here. It's a different scale. These different lines show the different size basis sets, and some of the existing methods, including quantum chemistry DMRG. But so what we have with our Gausslets is a scale parameter that sort of sets the typical size of these functions, and then we can smoothly decrease that. It's not monotonic, but it converges very well. And in the end, it looks like it's converging sort of in a nicer way than these other methods. We can get closer to what we think is the best result. So I think you could say that this at least is, at least from this plot, that this is arguably the best of these methods that all use these Gaussian basis sets. Okay, so more details on this. So this was all done with sort of standard DMRG with the matrix product operator compression. The DMRG really worked very nicely, and I attribute some of that to the sort of paying attention to the area law and having these functions that sort of don't spread out too much. So when we do a DMRG calculation, we like to extrapolate in the truncation error. And if that extrapolation is working pretty well, then we're sort of happy. And the number, the bond dimension, M is the bond dimension. And this is not too large compared to what we're used to. So this is converging very nicely on this scale of the competing methods with a relatively small bond dimension. Now there are, this is still, on the order of thousands of sites. So it's still a big calculation, but it's converging rather nicely. Okay. Chemists like to look at things that look like potential energy curves as you pull atoms apart, and this is showing different bond lengths and showing some of the quantum chemistry DMRG and the other methods in our Gausslets, just sort of seeing there at where the other ones seem to be headed. Finally, here's a more detailed comparison of how accurate the results are. This is all energy differences. And so we subtracted off the what we thought was the best method and then compared everybody else to that. Now, when we did that, we found that we seemed to be converging to something different from the best method. And we actually found that a method that we thought wasn't as good was actually better. And so we found that we agreed with one of the quantum Monte Carlo methods extremely well, and everybody else was different. And so these plots show sort of our convergence. Again, this same H10 system converging these two methods together as we decrease the spacing. Okay, so to conclude, quantum chemistry and electronic structure is a fruitful area for tensor network methods, but it's also a mature area. And so it's challenging to rise above the noise and have an impact. So we've focused on sort of the simplest aspect of this, which is setting up decent Hamiltonians for use with DMRG or tensor networks, or I should add also for quantum computer quantum simulation, the same sorts of aspects of having a simple Hamiltonian go into that. So Mira and its connection to wavelets have allowed us to set up our Gausslet bases. And for these hydrogen chain systems, they're giving state-of-the-art results. At the single particle level, we're focusing now on making these work better for things beyond hydrogen, larger atomic number Z. And a key ingredient of that is adding Gaussians to the Gausslet bases. Now, you might wonder if you could do much of the same tricks that we've done just by working with a pure grid. And probably there are a lot of tricks that can be used that make things very similar. One thing that I have no idea how to do is just to throw in another function to your basis when you're working with a grid. With basis sets, you can always just throw in another function and orthogonalize it. And that turns out to be a very effective approach for representing a singularity. So that's a key advantage. We also have a constraint that we're trying to maintain this diagonal representation, keep the Hamiltonian simple. Okay, so this is ongoing work. And the ultimate goal is to make bases with, say, on the order of 50 sites per atom for very accurate calculations with this simple form of the Hamiltonians. And then we could turn on PEPs to simulate broad classes of molecules and solids. Okay, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Stephen, for this nice talk. Are there any questions? Yes, Glenn.
Sorry, let me just turn my camera on if I can. I don't think I can, actually. Oh. Never mind. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Glenn. I hope I didn't... I hope I set you up nicely for your talk.
Oh, that was very useful. Thank you. So you said when you're setting up the Gausslets, you took some standard wavelets and then you did some extra tuning of them. Could you repeat how you tuned them after that?
Yes. Okay, so let's go back to my little schematic here. Okay, so arrays of Gaussians like this uniform array of Gaussians have sort of delightful properties as, I'm a fan of numerical analysis, mm-hmm. And it turns out that arrays of Gaussians have delightful properties in terms of, they're not exactly complete in terms of polynomial completeness, but as you take the fixed array and you make the width wider, their completeness grows fast like a Gaussian, e to the minus x squared sort of behavior. So it gets good really fast. So the trouble with an array of Gaussians is that they're not orthogonal. And so in order to orthogonalize them, you're going to get really long tails. You're going to get tails that might be falling off as 1 over x. I'm not sure analytically, but they're very fast. Or the very slow fall off. Okay, and so we don't want that. And so one way to go would be to do a perfect orthogonalization of the Gaussians and then feed them into one of our wavelet transforms. Feeding it into the wavelet transform, decimates them and gets rid of a lot of the tail, but it would still have sort of longer tails than we want. So I found that you could put in, it's essentially a convolution. It's sort of a partial attempt to orthogonalize. You say, I'm not going to orthogonalize it all the way because I still have a wavelet transform to go through. So I do a partial one, and then I feed it this, and I put in as one of the properties that we're trying to get in the optimization that the final result is perfectly orthogonal. Okay, if you do that, all the other properties that the fixed point wavelets have, the nice properties like the moments, come out sort of automatically. And so you just have to sort of try to, you just shoot for the orthogonalization in this sort of funny way, and you get the, it's like you're using the fixed point wavelet, except for this sort of extra smoothness and simple form, analytic form.
Okay, so you're kind of using, if I'm understanding correctly, you're using the wavelets to transform the Gaussians to remove these longer tails to make a nicer set.
Okay. Yeah, so half of the removal of the long tails is through the orthogonalizer and half of it is through the wavelet transform. The other thing that is sort of looking at the wavelet, you know, the way people do things in wavelets, I was struck by how often they go straight to the fixed point limit. And, you know, there's all sorts of tricks that seem to exist with just doing a few layers, one layer, two layers, et cetera. And, you know, maybe you switch the layers when you do one layer, then switch to another layer. It seemed like all sorts of tricks. So that's just sort of an outgrowth. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Any more questions?
I would like to ask a question, Steve.
Frank.
So you briefly talked about DFT and the fact that this is extremely successful. So have you ever managed to relate basically the calculations that DFT people do to wave functions? Do you have a feeling of what kind of wave functions you would have to optimize over such as to reproduce the results of DFT?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I understand the question. I haven't thought about it in exactly that way. You know, there's part of DFT is exact, and when you hear talks on DFT, there's usually a big emphasis on that part, which I think is partially misleading because the exact part you can't do anything with. Basically we have this one-to-one relationship between, the sort of potential that you add to the system and the density, and that you can, it's basically just sort of matching up a one-to-one relationship that you can sort of use to think about the this sort of single fermion representation of sort of giving you the right density for the exact system. But I don't think I quite understand what you're thinking about.
And my question is indeed not very well defined, but it's just that I always found this very frustrating that it's difficult to associate something like a Hartree-Fock function to DFT kind of calculation. You would like to have an idea of what is the Hilbert space that they are working in, or what kind of wave functions do these results correspond to, basically? And I certainly don't have the answer. And I think it's a very different. Yeah. I think it's not easy at all, but it would be nice to have at least an idea of what this amounts to. But okay, I know it's a very difficult.
My question is, does it amount to anything? We could implement the exact functional. So the functional in DFT, people sometimes say you don't know what it is. It's not that you don't know it. It's just an algorithm instead of a formula. And the algorithm is you solve your problem with DMRG, you find the density, and then you just, invert to get a potential. And that sort of defines your functional. It just has this sort of step. Maybe you use something besides DMRG, but it just needs this exact solver put in.
But even if you would have this exact functional, can you then write down the wave function that corresponds to the results that you have?
Well, the DFT will always give you a fermion determinant with just, and it will have not necessarily anything to do with the structure of the wave function you're trying to represent. If you do it for something that is a spin liquid far from a fermionic determinant, it will give you a fermionic determinant that mimics the density, and it will have some structure that gives you the energy, but it sort of, it doesn't have any overlap with the states itself. And all of the approximations, the source of their improvement in accuracy comes from quantum Monte Carlo calculations of the interacting electron gas. the interacting electron gas, again, doesn't have any exotic spin liquid or superconductivity or anything like that going on in it.
Yeah. I have to apologize. It's not a good question in some sense, but nevertheless, it's something very. It's something I find this frustrating that you cannot associate wave functions to DFT. And indeed, as you say, in principle, these are all kind of Slater determinants. But nevertheless, well, they should have some physical meaning. These wave functions that you get out of DFT, and I really don't know what.
Right.
Any more questions? Any last questions?
Well, I'm happy to field any questions I'm happy to field any questions that you might feel is too elementary to say in public in any of the chats or something.
Right, and or maybe we can carry the discussion forward on Remo. I've posted the link here. Please check it out. And yeah, maybe we can end here then. So I just want to thank Stephen again for this very nice talk.